Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, January 26, 2025, is by the Reverend Barbara Threat on the topic of From Gratitude to Reciprocity.
Meister Eckhart, a German Catholic priest, theologian, philosopher, and mystic who lived from around 1260 to around 1330, once said, "If the only prayer you ever say in your life is thank you, it will be enough." It's a phrase that I've often quoted. I've pondered it myself, and I've even referred to it in sermons. And there's a lot to that. There are many, many things that I at least take for granted to the extent that I completely forget to say thank you or to express any gratitude. And I suspect that's true for a lot of us. The fact that all of our cars started this morning to get here this morning is something to be grateful for, but I sure take it for granted. Then I came upon a paragraph in Robin Wall Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass, that caught my attention. She writes, "Sometimes in return for the gifts of the earth, gratitude is enough. It is our uniquely human gift to express thanks because we have the awareness and the collective memory to remember that the world could well be otherwise. But I think we are called to go beyond the culture of gratitude, to once again become cultures of reciprocity. Earlier in that chapter, Kimmerer talks about giving a lecture at a very exclusive college. She told a very old traditional story about the corn spirit and the people. There was a time, the story goes, when the harvest had been so plentiful for so many years that the people barely needed to work, and they began to take the corn for granted. Over time, they even forgot to do the traditional ceremonies, which blessed the corn, blessed the planting, and blessed the harvest. And then they began to misuse the corn. There was so much of it. They piled it in untidy heaps instead of stacking it carefully and respectfully. They actually got so lazy that instead of chopping firewood, they would just burn up the extra corn. And the corn spirit began to feel completely ignored. Eventually, the corn spirit decided to just leave the people altogether and go somewhere else where she would be appreciated. So the next year, only weeds grew in the fields, and the corn that had been so poorly stored became rotten and moldy. The people began to get hungry, and then they realized that they might even starve. When they abandoned gratitude, Kimmerer writes, their gifts abandoned them. But one small child, it's always a child, decided to do something about that. He left the village and wandered around calling for the corn spirit until he finally found her. She had been in a clearing not too far from the village. When the boy begged the corn spirit to return, she explained that while she had given her gifts generously and while she could do it again, the people had not kept their part of the bargain. They'd forgotten any kind of respect or gratitude. If the boy could persuade the people to act better, the corn spirit said, she would happily return to the village and help them provide good crops. That's what she loved to do. So the boy went back to the village and told the people what he'd found and what the corn spirit had said, and probably because they were near starvation, the people listened. They tried to take better care of the little pieces of corn that were left, and they began to do the appropriate rituals before they ate the corn. They carefully set aside enough to plant for the next year, even though that meant there was even less for food, and they invoked the corn spirit to bless it. And then they planted the seed with care and gratitude, and the next summer's harvest was plentiful again. Kimmerer said that many of the students were clearly bored by that story. Too many people found that implausible or alien. Corn spirits, indeed. How did some imaginary thing determine whether or not the crops would grow? And rituals that some imaginary spirit needed to hear? Those were fairy tales or folk myths and certainly not relevant to their lives. Then one student came up to her after most everyone had left. She spoke about being raised as a child in Turkey, where she'd been taught that everything that allows us to live is a gift. At night, she was expected to notice and thank the rafters of the house that protected her and the wool blankets that kept her warm. If a grain of rice fell to the ground, it could be a waste, so she was to pick it up and kiss it to show that no disrespect was intended. The depth of the gratitude that that woman felt, had been taught to feel, is humbling and inspiring. That level of awareness of the many gifts of life is rare. And to me, that story feels like a wonderful example of gratitude, but not quite a reciprocity, even though it follows Kimura talking about that. I doubt, frankly, that the rafters or the blanket or even the grains of rice registered anything, at least in my understanding of the world. Reciprocity means an exchange. The Latin root, and I don't speak Latin, is reciprocus. And the re part means back, and the pro part means forward. Reciprocity is giving back and forth. You treated me to lunch yesterday, so next week I'll buy you lunch or send you a bunch of flowers. In Kimura's terms, reciprocity is the response or reaction to the realizations that gratitude has brought to a person. I'm grateful. What will I do in return? It could be understood as that old saw, what goes around comes around, which often does seem to be true. If I'm mean and rotten to someone, the chances are very high that I'll get meanness and aggression in return. I may even have earned that. And it's nice and even comforting to believe that if I'm loving and kind, I'll get that back. And often that happens too. But not always. I may be grumpy to someone who reacts with compassion and care, asking gently what's troubling me. And there certainly have been times when I think I've been pleasant and kind and the other person is surly and short in response. It's not a perfectly balanced seesaw, this how we repay one another. Although it makes sense to try to put more gentle energy and kind acts in the world, there certainly are plenty of others putting in anger and hatred. But reciprocity is more than that. Kimura continues. Reciprocity teaches us why win-win relationships are a good way to go. Why waiters leave candies with the bill. Why it's a good idea to use the least force possible to secure an outcome. Reciprocity prompts us to rewrite the golden rule to say, do unto others, knowing that sometimes that same thing will be done to you. But I would argue if the only reason for giving or being kind or generous is so you'll get something back, isn't that being a bit manipulative and disingenuous? What about giving just for the sake of giving? Or giving in order to express what I'm feeling in a more tangible way? What is reciprocity? Kimura explains, in physics, reciprocity is Newton's third law, which states that for every force exerted by object A on object B, there is an equal but opposite force exerted on object B by object A. I remember high school physics. Every force, she reminds us, involves the interaction of two objects, where the force exerted by one is reciprocated with an equally powerful and opposite force on the other object. But human relationships, I want to tell her, are a whole lot more complicated than that. Even if things are equal in the long run, and I'm not at all sure that they are, they certainly don't always balance out in the moment. I can think of plenty of examples where kind and giving and compassionate people seem to struggle with all kinds of challenges in their life, and it doesn't seem fair at all. And I can think of other people who, at least to my eyes, seem to be entirely self-centered and mean-spirited and greedy, and they seem to have such an easy ride of it. I think sometimes of all it takes to care for an infant, the sleepless nights, the piles of laundry, the whole house rearranged and upset, trips to the doctor, and all kinds of new concerns. And what you get in return is a smile and an adorable coo. And it seems like a fair trade in the moment. It's not always so easy. The forces aren't equal or balanced. So what about reciprocity? And what does it have to do with gratitude? First of all, I agree with Kimura. I don't think it's sufficient to be grateful, although admittedly that's where I often stop and where I suspect many of us do. Being grateful, being aware of so many things in life that enrich or enliven us is certainly important and something I don't do often enough, especially when so many of the blessings that I have are unearned and unmerited. But I can sit at home and bask in my gratitude for life and for all that I have without giving any response. I could even get quite impressed with my capacity for gratitude. Without any level of reciprocity, it could make me feel a little bit more aware, perhaps, or more pious, or more spiritually advanced, which does no good for the world, only affects my ego. Gratitude arising from my being needs to move outward, too. Expressing our gratitude to one another is part of the social grease that makes life work. Each of us likes to feel recognized and appreciated, and gratitude can remind us of the many blessings that life has given us without our asking or earning them. Reciprocity, I think, is meant to be active. It goes beyond just a feeling into some form of doing. It may be simply demonstrating our gratitude, like the people who finally did the proper ritual to thank the corn spirit, or in real life when my grandson asks to borrow the car and offers to fill my wood box in exchange. Perhaps you, as a reader, express your gratitude for the vast variety of books that you've read by lending your support to a library or an organization that's opposing the banning of books. There's ways that gratitude can move us toward action. You're grateful, and so you go beyond just feeling grateful. You reciprocate. You spread the gratitude. Especially in light of recent events in the last few days, I'm thinking of reciprocity in a longer time scale. Yesterday, a friend sent me a column that she'd received yesterday morning, written by journalist and author Kristen Tippett, which spurred me to rewrite major parts of this sermon. I'll quote part of Tippett's column. She writes, "It is admittedly hard to write something this week that feels fitting to the moment or wise. This moment is overwhelming on so many fronts. I am devastated and demoralized, too, by this moment's ravages, by its shocking counterpoints of fragility and hubris. My heart breaks for the many human beings on the sharp edges of all that is breaking now. We're called to take what is harmful seriously and to care and protect actively as much as to calm in this moment. And, not but, and there is such a thing as deep time, too. The view of time of the geologist as well as the mystic, that long arc of the moral universe that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke of. Deep time doesn't recognize the delineations we make in terms of years or days. It will see what is being seeded and what we tend across the generations and the years. It will see what grows. The news that we say now is breaking is never seeing the whole of things. There's a much broader time scale." First of all, I was tremendously grateful for that reminder that this moment is not all there is. There is a much longer and larger picture. And then it had me wondering about reciprocity and that deep time, that longer view of time and large scale. I am reminded of how many things I take for granted which now seem under threat, things I am deeply grateful for which have felt increasingly under attack and which I fear may be even more under attack in months to come. I'll be a bit personal here. My younger daughter, who's now 50, has identified as a lesbian since early in her college years. One of the things I am most grateful for my life and hers is that since she was fourth grade, we were part of the San Diego UU Church, where our director of our large religious education program and one of my closest friends was a gay man, very much a part of her life. A lesbian woman from our church gave her several years of guitar lessons. And these two were simply people who were part of her church and part of her life. She knew their sexual orientation, and it made no difference to her. My teaching the UU sex ed curriculum to teens for so many years is in part my own form of reciprocity in response to the gratitude that I feel to my church's support and acceptance of my daughter, both the local church and our denomination. Some of the most joyous weddings I've ever done were the ones between same-sex couples in the first weeks after those marriages became legal in Massachusetts. And my older daughter's first child, who is 27, just this week completed the process of getting a new birth certificate with an amended name and an amended gender, which you can do in Massachusetts. Meredith is now legally a female. LGBTQ rights and the acceptance of trans people are very personal to me. The people that some refer to with disgust and disdain as those people are part of my family, and I know that they're part of some of yours too. It is clear that LGBTQ rights, including being recognized as a gender other than the one assigned by birth, are under attack. I believe that same-sex marriage will likely also come under attack. It already is in some places. I'm well aware of the secrecy and fear that were reality for so many gays and lesbians for much of our history, and still are in much of the world. And being an openly trans adult is almost unimaginable in many parts of the world, even in parts of our own country. It is terrifying to me to imagine the possibility that such conditions could again become real here. And I'm very, very grateful that my family lives in Massachusetts and not one of many other states. I have assumed for decades that gradually more care will be given to our environment. The river in Pittsburgh no longer catches fire. Our vehicles are more efficient, and recently there's been encouragement to make them more efficient still. Solar panels and windmills are generating more and more of our electricity, and the list goes on. I'm grateful for all of those things, although I've taken so much for granted that I always often forget to express my gratitude even in words, let alone do much to actively engage with those changes or encourage them. All of that could now be at risk. I have assumed for decades that our country is making progress in including all people, maybe even moving toward equality. Women doctors and construction workers, black airline pilots and teachers, Spanish signs in hospital elevators, a society that begins to recognize the long impact of slavery and institutional racism in hiring and admissions decisions, the world has seemed to be moving toward more inclusivity. And our government now seems to be intentionally trying to deny any racial inequities and outlaw any consideration of the benefits of diversity. Many of those things that I've taken for granted so much that I've forgotten to be grateful now seem like they're in jeopardy. And the list could go on. I suspect that we've all followed the news in the past few days, probably quite closely. And all of that has me thinking about reciprocity in another way. Perhaps part of the way to express my gratitude for those things I've taken for granted is by doing what I can to ensure that those things stay available. Perhaps I can do what I can to make sure that they're available to those who may not have those privileges now. And I can certainly realize that as an educated, economically stable, white, middle-class American woman, there are privileges which I have which allow me to ignore a whole large section of society. But if I do that, what does that say about my capacity for gratitude and my willingness to act on it? Perhaps as well as considering what I can do now to actively express my gratitude, I could consider how to pass on the many things for which I felt such gratitude. I'm reminded of Dorothy Day's words in our hymnal, which say, "A pebble cast in a pond causes ripples that spread out in all directions." Gratitude, I think, can be that pebble. And the ripples are the reciprocal action, many of which we cannot know, which go out in ways that we don't always control. The words about caring for the seventh generation come to mind, and those words claim many sources. Orrin Lyons, the chief of the Onondaga Nation, writes, "We are looking ahead, as is one of the first mandates given to us as chiefs, to making every decision that we make relate to the welfare and well-being of the seventh generation to come." What about the seventh generation? Where are you taking them, he asks. What will they have? Quaker sociologist Elise Boulding suggests that a person, we'll call this person Pat, consider the oldest relative or family friend who ever touched or knew Pat as an infant. For example, a great or even great-great-grandparent who might have been 90 years old. In the same way, Pat should consider the oldest relative or family friend who touched their great-grandparent as an infant, another 90-year-old person, so you're looking 180 years back. Then the calculation runs forward to the infant that Pat might touch or know towards the end of their lifetime. And then a number of years later until that infant has grown to old age and touches another infant. Seven generations. for Pat reaching into the past for 180 years or so and into the future for about another 180. In other words, Pat's existence touches that very, very wide span of time. What if I think of that deep time, that longer arc, as being just the span from my great-grandfather's great-grandfather, and I do remember my great-grandfather who was born in 1865, down to my great-grandchildren's great-grandchildren. That's probably a span of at least 300 years, whose lives have touched mine or whose lives I will touch. Those many greats grandparents who I never knew are part of the arc of my own life. Once in a while, I hear stories about them or learn facts about them. And I have no doubt that, for better or for worse, there are stories about me that will pass down. How can I express the gratitude that I feel for the many blessings of my life in such a way that they stay around for the generations to come and can bless those who I've never met? And it's not only my personal life, it's the things that I enjoy. Clean air, perhaps, rights for women. What can I do for that matter, just to help ensure that the circumstances my daughters live in as young to middle-aged adults, for which I truly am grateful, are there in 10 or 50 or 200 years for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren as they enter young adulthood and beyond? What if I expand that golden rule to say not, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, but do unto others as you would have done to the seventh generation forward? And at the very least, demonstrate how grateful you are by passing it on to someone else and making sure they have the same things to be grateful for that you do. I would suggest that saying thank you is not enough, not even as a prayer, with all due regards to Eckhart. Our gratitude, if it has any meaning beyond just making us feel good, must extend to reciprocity. It must lead us to act on our gratitude in some way that enhances our corner of the world, that does our part to ensure that the things which we have been blessed with are there for others still to come. Each of us will do that differently, of course, should we decide to do so. But perhaps now, when so much could become so precarious, is a particularly important time to remember what we're grateful for and then find ways to ensure that those things continue to be sources of gratitude for others. It's time to move from feeling to action, from inward gratitude, as important as that is, to outward reciprocation. May we be so bold and so generous.